Welcome to the Three Film Egos. I'm your hirsute host, Isaac Jensen, and with me as always is Utah's whitest black child, Clayton Godby.
Moted.
And our resident vegan dreadlocked Portlandier, Ryan Cragen.
Moted.
This is a film discussion podcast where we each pick a film based on a predetermined theme or topic and then talk about anything but. There will be tangents. There will not be spoiler alerts. Consider yourselves warned. On this episode, movies based on graphic novels.
Graphic novels.
Graphic novels it is.
All right. Movies based on graphic novels. It was originally comic books, but I decided graphic novels sounded better, especially because Road to Perdition and V for Vendetta were specifically graphic novels.
Wasn't Ghost World also actually a graphic novel, not a comic?
It got released as a
Ghost
graphic
World,
novel.
It started as a comic book that got compiled into a graphic novel.
I only have the graphic novel.
I have, V for Vendetta was, I believe it was 10 issues.
And
Yeah, it is great. Better than the movie, for sure, but we'll get into that.
Why don't we start with that? V for Vendetta is a graphic novel movie. V for Vendetta was my pick, and I picked it because I actually owned a Blu-ray copy, and I have for about a year and a half, and I had never gotten around to seeing it yet. So this was kind of an excuse to see that. And Misty has really liked it, and yeah, that was the reason I picked it. Simple enough.
It's pretty legit.
I remember when this film first came out, I was blown away by it, and I like loved it, and I went and bought it on DVD. And then it seems like my second and third times watching it, I was a little bit less impressed. But it's definitely really good performances. Nat Portman is great. I like the themes of resistance. I always like sci-fi that has kind of a governmental part of it, like corruption in the government and control of thought. So those are themes that I really connect with in this film.
This is the only movie of the three that I've actually read the source material for. And so when I watch the movie, I have to compare it a lot to the source material. And it's way different in certain aspects that kind of just makes me upset. But overall, I kind of just wish that they would have done this movie how they did, but actually used the real script to do it.
The real script, you mean from the novel?
Yeah, if they actually used the source material properly and actually kept the same storyline and the same... Well, I mean, they kept most of the characters, but they changed around a lot of the history. I can go into specifics if you want, but... They omit so much of what makes the graphic novel so good and so relevant to me that it kind of just gets lost. And they lose the complete overall meaning of what Moore had when he wrote it.
Let's go into that. What was the meaning?
Okay, so in the Wachowskis' V for Vendetta, you basically have a fascism versus, a liberalism versus a conservatism. You've got these conservative parties that end up being kind of fascists, right? And then you've got V, who's kind of this liberal who's freeing everybody. And it's not like that in the graphic novel so much. He's a much grittier character, and it's definitely about fascism directly and anarchy. He's a direct anarchist, and he's not really out there for the people so much. He's out there to create anarchy.
So in the novel, there was a little less ambiguity about the good or evil nature of V. It was just straight ahead, this is a dude trying to just bring down the government.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And see, that's one of the points in the movie, and I haven't read the graphic novel, but that's one of the points in the movie that I felt like just got beat to death and maybe became a little bit annoying for me, is just like how almost patriotic and for the people V was in the film. And it just seemed almost like to get preachy, like resistance, you know, like stand up, freedom forever, as the movie poster says. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps I would like the graphic novel more than I ended up liking the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely different. They romanticize a whole lot of his killing in the movie, whereas in the books, it's so much more brutal and varied. You know, he doesn't just kill somebody silently in their sleep and gives them a rose. There's some pretty deathly murder scenes. Yeah,
I wouldn't necessarily say, at least from my perspective, that it was overly preachy. I think there were a few scenes where we kind of see V struggle with his desire to stay on his righteous path, and between that and giving it up to, you know, maybe live a normal life. I mean, they probably could have done more with it, but I'm kind of the one scene where he takes off the mask. It's after he lets Natalie Portman's character leave, and he throws his mask at the mirror and it shatters. And I don't know, maybe I'm reading into that, but you know, it seemed like to me, well, it emphasized it at the end. It's like he was fighting more for an idea, for not necessarily for the strict purpose of bringing down a corrupt government, but to empower the people to escape the fear-based tyranny of a corrupt government. It wasn't necessarily anti-government, it was pro-people.
That's true. I don't think you're reading too much into the breaking of the mirror. I think his interior conflict there is a good conclusion to make. I don't know. I think it's a good metaphor.
Thinking back, I watched it yesterday, actually, so it's really fresh in my mind. That's really the only scene where we see that conflict. So maybe it's actually kind of out of place. For the rest of the film, he is just 100% committed to his cause, his idea.
Right, but you realize that his character comes over through an arch, and at the end he decides that it's not his choice to make, and he gives it to somebody else. So I think that mirror-breaking scene is a symbol for he's actually changing.
Oh, could be, yeah.
Natalie,
decision over to the people.
He seems that he goes through a few different changes throughout the whole movie. And I think that's the symbol of, you know, symbol of him changing yet again. It's definitely a struggle for his character.
Stylistically, I loved this movie as well. I thought it was just an incredible piece of work.
I liked some of the action sequences, the slowed down cinematography, the slow motion. I don't know, and it's definitely beautiful. The camera seems to be placed in the right place at all times, and great composition of the frame and everything. I had no complaints from that aspect.
Yeah, beautifully shot and beautifully decorated. I think it's a beautiful movie. I think my favorite scene in particular is the prison scene when she's reading the note.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite scene in the movie. You basically have this woman. You know, it's a history lesson of how things got to where they are, and you can see the corruption. And I think that's just a beautiful scene. I mean, it's really just a love story, you know, in 10 minutes, but it was pretty moving.
Yeah, agreed. And it helped fill in all the gaps of how things got to where they were, and kind of emphasize the point of, you know, little by little, if you let a government take more control, before you know it, they are controlling everything.
Sure.
Yeah, that may have been the point at which, I guess, just the themes that it was trying to drive home, maybe the message of the film, maybe that's where I'm getting the feeling that it was a little bit preaching to me more than I wanted, was maybe during that scene, because it's drawing those conclusions, and maybe like almost directly trying to point fingers at certain movements politically that are going on now, which is appropriate and happens a lot in sci-fi. And I was actually, this is probably the fourth time I've seen this movie. And I was less bothered this time. Maybe I was just watching too much when it first came out in 2004, was it, or 2005?
2006.
Yeah, I probably watched it two or three times that year.
So maybe it was George Bush fatigue that kind of colored your opinion.
Well, that was the whole point. That's what I kept drawing the change, because he doesn't fight these sorts of characters in the graphic novel at all. And so it definitely felt like it was tailored to a Bush-era conservative versus liberal piece as opposed to fascism versus anarchy, which is how
right.
The graphic novel was.
Which I'm in favor of stuff like that. Like, I think I'm getting to a point now where even when a movie is based on a book or a novel or graphic novel, to me, they become separate entities. Just because a movie is based on a book doesn't mean that it's necessarily bound to that source material. It becomes its own thing. Mm-hmm. So for this, to translate the source material into a modern-day kind of fable, I think is fine. And I think they did a brilliant job with that regard, because watching it now with what's going on in America now with I mean, you look at the top three Republican conservative candidates, and at the root of it, pretty much theocrats. They, I think all, I mean, especially Bachman and Rick Perry, would very much support a Christian takeover of the government. I mean, they probably wouldn't say that in public, of course, but they're, you know, supported by the Tea Party, especially with Bachman, I think. And it's just nutty to me to see people want to support a theocratic government. Because when you're no longer free to decide your beliefs, then... Or if you're no longer free to not believe, then you actually are not free to believe.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying with that?
Yeah, I get
it. It's kind of what this film was displaying. It's at the very top of it, you have this theocrat with that pseudo cross as their symbol of the party. And everything was, think of the slogan of the party, it was strength through unity, unity through faith.
Which is
and
changed
everything
from the
that was,
novel too.
Yeah, and everything that was anti that party, they would ban. I mean, you look at the TV guy, the host that worked with Natalie Portman's character. They find a Quran in his house, and they kill him.
Well, so they found a lot more regard, in that house, I think, than just a
Quran.
Yeah,
but V, I single that out because V specifically singled that out after he gets done with Natalie Portman's initiation into No Fear. So in that regard, on this theme specifically of be careful about your government, you should not fear your government, the government should fear you, I think this may actually be one of the most important films of this 21st century.
It's one of the first that would come to my mind for examples of that. And I really think it does a really good job at also being entertaining and accessible. There's a lot of action. There's a lot to look at. There's a lot to think about. And you've got a long time to think about it. It builds appropriately to the climax. And I think the climax may have been a little bit too grand and large for me. But at the same time, it was something, I don't know, you feel it when at the end with all the explosions and everything. You feel the power of what's going on and what it means for the people in Great Britain for that, for this setting. And so I think all in all, it's just a great movie.
Yeah, do you think the ending was a bit optimistic?
I thought it was great. I thought it was a celebration of destruction, you know?
Yeah, actually, I didn't think it was too grand at all. I was just sitting there reveling in this success story of, like, maybe the people can take back their freedom from the government.
But what you ask, I think it might be. It might be a little bit unreal. I don't know. It seems like everything is so divided. No matter what movement you look at, there's always a very divided population looking at it. There's people on both sides all the time, and it seems really like more universal than would be possible for everybody to put on the V masks. But I don't know. It was exciting. It was cool to see visually and thematically. It's what you wanted to happen and what needed to happen for the plotline.
Yeah, and what does it say about us, at least me anyway, that to think, to be so jaded by political corruption that the ending didn't seem realistic, that if them failing probably would have been more realistic to me?
Yeah.
Right, but political dialogue in this country isn't even real, you know?
Right.
I feel like it's all a sham. It's a distraction that's perpetuated by the news media to keep people focused on ideas and issues that are non-issues. Like, I don't care about said actors, whatever, or I don't care about gay rights because I feel like it's just a non-issue. It shouldn't be an issue, and so I hate that we worry about it so much.
I've never thought about that, whether it's a sham. I don't know.
Right. Well, I mean,
it's all shiny keys.
Right. I mean, so in the graphic novel, they point out the arms of the government. And so they don't go into this in the movie as far as I can tell. I mean, they refer to the secret police as the Fingermen, but you don't actually know what that is. I mean, there's the hand, the finger, the eye, the nose, and the mouth. And those are representative of all of the forms of government. And a lot of them, and one of them is the mouth, which is the propaganda division. And so I feel like so many of these ideas that were in the graphic novel are just omitted completely from this,
yeah,
this book, that are so crucial to how they're doing this to us. So this movie's telling us a whole lot to stand up, but it's not telling us how they're controlling us. Does that make
sense?
Yeah,
and it might be difficult. Yeah, it might be difficult to translate such a grand, you know, message from you know, a novel into a, you know, 2-hour film. But I think for the intended purpose of, you know, reminding us that we better check our government, I think it still succeeds on that, in that regard. But maybe it would have been better as like a 10-part HBO miniseries or something.
I don't know. I think it's good for the audience. Yeah. I think it plays well to a certain audience that I hope got its message, which is good. I don't know if people could sit down and handle V for, you know, 10 hours.
Yeah.
Seems long.
Yeah, most people don't have the attention span.
Mm-hmm. I also thought it was a great performance by Hugo Weaving. I think it's probably going to be really hard to act in a movie where you don't have your face.
He actually wasn't the man behind the mask.
Really? Well, great.
Yeah, it was someone else. And I believe the person recorded dialogue, but they didn't like it enough, so they got Hugo Weaving to dub it all in.
Oh.
I think,
that's good.
I think I've heard that.
Well, whoever acted in Hugo Weaving's place did great, I thought. I was interested in what he was doing, and he was acting without a face, which I think is crucial to most acting.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, to have someone be so compelling without any actual facial expressions. That's powerful filmmaking.
Exactly. I thought Natalie Portman's accent was the worst part of the movie, probably.
Yeah. It kind of bothered me at first because I thought, wait a minute, she's not English, and it's kind of obvious. But I was able to ignore it after a minute.
Yeah, it's god awful.
Really? I didn't even notice.
I thought it was horrible.
Huh. I don't talk to British people enough, I guess.
Well, did you not listen to anybody else in the entire movie? They sounded great, and when I heard her, it just completely took me out of the movie. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, I wonder why I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I get bugged by weird things. I don't know. It wasn't believable to me. I didn't like it, but it's okay. The rest of her performance is pretty good, so I'm not really...
Yeah, everyone else spoke with kind of a subdued, kind of dignified tone, where she was very expressive and very kind of spazzy, so that might be the difference.
A little over-enthused.
Yeah, she does that a lot. Well, not that much, but she does that.
So one of my favorite scenes is obviously the prison scene. You have the side story of, you know, the two girls... But the ethics of putting Natalie Portman in this prison cell to teach her to be fearless, how do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, that's a troubling thought. And I think they kind of glossed over it a little too quick.
Yeah.
Although I think Natalie Portman did a great job of portraying the emotions behind that and then having them just almost immediately click off. That did not ring false to me, so I think that was a successful. But yeah, the ethics involved... I think if they had done a better point of portraying why he felt he had to do that, it might have been, you know, I might have been able to get behind it a little bit. But because she just kind of went back to society and kind of, you know, worked from the inside, I don't know. Ethically, no. I don't think it's right to do that.
I would say it's not. I would say ethically that's not right to do. But at the same time, why do we need B to be ultimately ethical all the time? And I think it makes sense with the story for him to almost disregard one person's feelings or ethics toward one person for the end game of the goal that's going to benefit the whole country and the whole world. Makes sense, but ethically I'd say no, that's not cool.
Especially because it probably... only be detrimental to his cause. I mean, for someone to have such a just cause and then to do something so, you know, unethical and kind of contradictory to his cause might diminish the just aspect of it.
Exactly. I mean, and what is the doctor really accused of doing in this? Supposedly doing harm for the benefit of mankind, right? And he kills her for that crime.
And then he does the same.
He does the same thing.
And it kind of comes down to the perception of the rationale behind these decisions. I mean, the doctor was killing people for the good of mankind, but ended up working against the people because the government took control of that and used it to put the people in a state of fear to be able to get more control. Whereas V is trying to do it to recapture the people away from that fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. When it comes to revolution, both sides always end up with blood on their hands.
Yeah. I thought about the doctor because she did not cause that invention or to reach the people. She didn't cause the mass reaping of that. It wasn't her fault that everybody experienced that. It was just her fault that the select few did. That's interesting. Yeah, I see very little difference there now that you bring it up.
I don't know. That age old
questions of do the ends justify the means?
Yeah, but when you're trying to be like an ethical warrior and fighting for an idea, it seems a little bit ridiculous to go against that same idea that you're supposed to be a revolutionary for.
Yeah.
Just ultimate freedom, right? He's fighting for freedom and fighting for the people, and yet he oppresses, you know, the one he loves the most. I think in the end he justifies it saying that he's trying to free her, and that's what she really wanted. She wanted, so she asked him to do this, you know, somehow, is his logic. I don't buy it.
Yeah.
What she learns in this is the same thing that she probably would have learned if Creedy had gotten her and interrogated her. It would have been the same thing. She'd crack then, and she would have been fearless if they actually did it to her. But he simulates it in a way that she'll learn it without actually having to go through it and maybe actually dying. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, that's another interesting question, is what would have happened had she given up the information? What would V have done? Would he have killed her? Too much of a liability, or what?
Nah, I don't think so. I hope not.
I think it was crucial to include these elements of torture because of how prescient that was with Guantanamo going on at the time. And still
right.
is going on.
Yeah, it's an interesting one for me. It's really hard for me to detract so much from the source material. I'm usually good at adaptations, but for this one, so much of what I love about it, they take out. And so it just kind of,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll have to come up with an excuse to watch Watchmen so we can talk about that one, too.
Yes, same thing.
Very different from the source material.
Yeah, I kind of don't like adaptations of comic book movies. I prefer, you know, a completely new idea with comic book characters.
Yeah, but that's really not how Hollywood's working these days.
Yeah, well, right, they see something that's successful and they're just going to milk the shit out of it. See, what else did we have? We had Ghost World and Road to Perdition.
Where are we going? I think we should go to Ghost World because I think I have less favorable things to say about that than I do about Road to Perdition.
Really? Okay.
And I want to end on a high note. So yeah, go ahead, Clayton. Introduce the film, and then we'll get into it.
Sure. So Ghost World, one of my favorite graphic novels. Definitely my favorite graphic novelist, Daniel Clowes. Probably his most accessible and least strange story became the movie Ghost World. And I like it. It features Scarlett Johansson in this role, and she is not a great actress, and she really doesn't do anything different here than you see her do in other roles that she's played. It's also got Thora Birch, who is cool, Steve Buscemi, who is a master, and one of my favorite roles of his whole filmography.
So it's kind of quintessential Buscemi. I mean, here I think he's more Buscemi even in any other of his roles.
Yeah, yeah, just such a nerdy geek collector guy.
He's so versatile. He's the best part of the movie.
Oh, he can do so many things. And here I really, actually one of my favorite parts of this movie is his role. It kind of is the connection in this story to a theme that Daniel Clowes uses in a lot of his graphic novels, of the idea of being a collector of things, strange things and historical things. And in this film, Steve Buscemi's character really does that. And through that collection and these kind of findings, Enid, Thora Birch's character, has some self-discovery and things like that. And so that idea of collecting things and then that changes your life or changes other people's lives is kind of a common thread in a lot of graphic novels by this novelist. But the movie specifically is really cool. Two young girls graduate high school, don't know what to do with themselves, but they're kind of social outsiders. They make fun of people a lot, which I've heard as a negative critiquing of the film. Like, it's just so mean. They're so mean to everybody, which might be true, but I get a laugh out of it. I laugh probably more times throughout this movie than most comedies of a less dark nature. It's a very dark comedy based upon the ridiculousness of real life. And that's why I like this movie.
Yeah, this is one, when I was first getting into movies, this is one I was a really big fan of. But it's probably been like 4 or 5 years since I've seen it, and I think I'm just getting old. I'm becoming an old man. I mean, I'm only 27, but watching it now, I mean, it's not to say I didn't like it. I still enjoyed the film. But I looked at these two as those stupid fucking hipsters that I hate now.
Well, and that's what they are, really.
Yeah, it's like when I watched it 5 years ago, I didn't really know what hipsters were, but now I'm watching it now. It's like, oh, they're the people I see all around town that are experiencing things through a thick layer of irony and just really have no sense of self or direction. So I started to kind of resent these two characters. I mean, I'm kind of using some hyperbole just to kind of for laughs. Because I still like the film, but not as much as I used to. Because I used to identify with these characters quite a bit. I mean, I remember being in that weird, you know, 2 or 3 years after high school, transitioning out of being a good Mormon schoolboy into not that, and feeling just such severe alienation from everywhere. Yeah, but now that I'm set and secure in my ways, I feel that connection with the characters is kind of lost. And I actually relate more to Steve Buscemi's character because I totally understand that collecting, that totally just nerdy, geeky, I want to know everything there is to know about this and I want to share it with people. And I know when they don't want to hear it, but I'm going to tell them anyway. I mean, that's probably the primary reason why I started the podcast.
No, I'm definitely on the same boat
with
you.
Yeah.
I definitely associated a lot more with these characters when I was younger, when I first saw this movie. And I still do a little bit in certain ways. Her love for music, I definitely understand. That's one thing that she does know that she likes. She knows that she likes art. She just doesn't know how to express herself completely yet without just being, you know, a bitch. But I definitely associate most with Steve Buscemi. His record collecting, and his taste, his art, it's great.
Well, and see, I don't resent the characters at all in this, just because I am in a different place now. Well, I won't deny being partially a hipster. I won't deny it. I mean, there are a lot of things that are attributed to a hipster lifestyle that I very
much
like.
Really know what that means.
It's hard to pinpoint what that means exactly.
It's too ironic.
But, But the fact that I once did identify with them and saw them almost as being representative of who I was kind of represents some sort of victory in the filmmaking for me, that the characters feel real enough, that those people could exist, that people like that do exist. And I can appreciate that even though it's not me. And, you know, the things they laugh about, I find myself laughing about as well sometimes. Not, I don't know, like funny things people say. I don't know. It's not cool to make fun of people, but there's a lot of irony around to look at as well. And I don't know. It seems like they're at least striving to think outside of the box and look at things the way they are. So I like the characters, even though I see their faults, I guess, is the way to sum that up.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a different take on a coming-of-age story, because no one really seems to learn anything. Whereas with coming-of-age stories, someone always comes out on top. This is like, well, we're kind of in this weird, awkward stage where we don't know what we're doing. And at the end, no one has really learned anything. If anything, people's lives are a little bit worse.
Well, I think one of the ideas that it's supposed to leave you with is like, okay, maybe it didn't work out the way we thought it would. Maybe our lives are a little bit worse, but the important thing is that we're seeing it now the way that it is, and I can move forward, you know, at the end of the movie, like getting on the bus, I can get on my bus, and I'll find something that works for me. Like, nothing here is really working for me. It's that idea of compromise and do something and be unhappy at it, like, keep working until you can find something that fulfills you.
Yeah, I think that might be a little
too optimistic.
And that's
something I still identify with.
That might be a little too optimistic, a reading of the ending. What I see there is continuation of the cycle of running away from problems. Like, but this is the ultimate way to escape everything that has been alienating Enid. It's like she is not comfortable anywhere, so she gets on a bus to nowhere. But ultimately, she's not going to be comfortable there, because it really comes down to she's probably not comfortable with herself.
Well, I can understand wanting to get away from where she's at, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think the story definitely, and the title is a whole lot about where she lives in the city of ghosts, you know, the same monotonous relationships with people, the same buildings, the same chains. I think it makes fun of these, you know, diners, you know, that are authentic 60s diners that aren't really that, you know. So I can understand her wanting to escape from it all, but I don't necessarily know if she hasn't been at least somewhat enlightened by the end of this movie.
Yeah, when you put it that way, it's like, yeah, she's running away from all the cycles she sees around her. I mean, you look at her dad, who keeps going back with the same woman, and then you know, stuff like that. So maybe it is the ultimate escape. Maybe it's like, I got to get out of here before this world consumes me.
Well, it was always her main dream, too, you know? She said to her, the one thing she's always wanted to do was just to go on an adventure.
Yeah, to just go. Leave. Just get a bus ticket and leave. And so I think I can see your kind of reading of the conclusion of the film, Isaac, but for me it represented like at least a little bit of hope. Definitely still running. Like, she's, I mean, the movie ends and the character has much to learn still, and there's no question about that, but for me it represented a little bit of hope. Like, maybe if it's not working, if things aren't working out for you, you gotta try something else. You gotta, you know, find a change. And so
Yeah, and it's not that I didn't see that hope. I see that hope. I mean, if maybe not as much as I did back when I first saw this film, but it's still there. But the way I look at it now, having so many more years of experience under my belt, is she is very ill-equipped to handle what this adventure is going to bring, even though the adventure is very much welcome and needed. But I think I'm way too over-intellectualizing this movie.
Yeah, well, the ending
too hard.
The ending has a bit of dissonance from the it's way different than the feel of the rest of the movie. It's kind of a dark comedy, but it's very laughable, very funny throughout. And then the end is this weird, like, ambiguous, like, artistic message, maybe, or it means nothing, maybe. It's open for
very
interpretation.
Curious.
Yeah, and yeah, so I think in that way it was a little bit strange, weird ending, where it just doesn't almost fit the rest of the film.
But of course, the best part is Doug at the convenience store.
Oh, yeah, nunchucks, are you kidding me? That guy was out of control.
It's a wake-up.
This isn't Woodstock. America, dude, learn the rules. That guy's ridiculous.
Yeah, that is just too much. That guy was too much. He was by far the best character in the whole story.
Yeah,
I could watch a movie of just 2 hours of him in front of that gas station, and that would have been just as fun for me.
Sidewinder.
Yeah.
Citizens arrest, dude, call the police. He's nunchucking Steve Buscemi.
Oh, it's awesome.
So, what did you guys make of the Coons chicken poster, or, you know, the painting? Her getting kicked out of art class for that, for being offensive.
I think that is definitely a real, probably real world scenario, or could be, anyway. Although I applaud and support the art teacher's initial desire to have that hung to cultivate that discussion. I'm all for controversial works of art that promote discussion. Even if they don't, even if the only discussion is, I don't think that's art, I still think there is a place for art like that.
Yeah, I don't think the offensive nature of it is something that, I don't know, should be censored or, I don't know. I think that you see scenarios like that all the time. Everywhere, especially high school level, higher education is maybe a little bit better at dealing with that, more tolerance of art with a message. But I liked it. I liked that it was a part of the film. It kind of fleshes out the atmosphere there of the ghost world, of this environment where, you know, they don't want things to be said, or when things are said, they're kind of pseudo-intellectual or pseudo-artistic, and just people's misunderstanding of anything that's different from their experience.
Yeah, they don't like it. Their feathers ruffled. But I think that that's pretty much the case for just about any kind of small town in America. I mean, you don't see many markets for controversial art in small towns.
Yeah, very true. That's one of the reasons you see a lot of people from where we all grew up moving away from here to places like Portland or Washington. Is that kind of... There's just not a lot of people who will understand an artistic discussion or want to have an artistic discussion.
Well, I mean, art isn't necessarily the only reason to move away. Certainly not the only reason I left. Food was probably the main
reason. Oh, yeah, I wasn't claiming that as the reason I left. But I have a lot of friends. It seems like every year move away to Portland or to New York. It's because they want to have more opportunities than can be afforded in a smaller Utah town.
To communities where this kind of discussion is encouraged as opposed to stifled, like in Utah County. And so that's always been my point of censorship. Censorship, I never support for any reason, because I think if you censor, there's no longer an opportunity to learn. And I think knowledge is the ultimate power for anyone.
Hear, hear.
But yeah, I think the strongest part of this movie is how eccentric and fully realized all these characters are.
Yeah, it's just like it's really entertaining characters. Some are a little bit hyperbolized or just exaggerated, crazy, almost unreal, but it rings with truth. Like you can see the truth behind where it comes from.
So you've read the graphic novel then, Clayton? I haven't.
Yeah.
Is Steve Buscemi's character a composite character of multiple other characters?
He's not. He's represented in one character. And in fact, this is a very literal representation of the graphic novel. I was really surprised because I saw the movie first in high school, loved it. And then it's just the last few years I got the graphic novel and read it, then watched the movie. And it's pretty close in the storytelling. The ending is identical. A lot of the lines are taken straight from it.
Would I gain any more insight into the movie or the characters if I actually read them through the novel?
No. I think you got it already. It says what the book said as well. But still a cool book. I don't know that there are additional scenes. There are other scenes, but I think that the moments that they chose from the book and made into scenes in the movie, they did so because those are the most crucial scenes for you to understand where the characters are coming from and the building up of the character arcs and all of that. I don't know. I guess if you like this movie, go get the graphic novel, because it'll just be a little bit more of the same, but it's pretty similar.
None of us have read Road to Perdition, right?
No.
Nope.
Well, then I guess we can judge the movie based on its own merits. So let's move into that one.
You got to understand, Isaac, is that, I don't know, for me, a graphic novel is closer to a movie than just a normal book, because you've got frames and scenes. And so, I don't know, maybe that's why.
Oh, no, I wasn't being critical of that. I was just trying to segue, and that might have been a little clunky.
Oh, that's all right. I chose Road to Perdition mostly because I wanted to watch it again. I never really need an excuse to rewatch a Sam Mendes movie. But basically, it's Tom Hanks. He's a mob enforcer named Michael Sullivan, and along with his son, they're probably the leads of this story. Basically, a job goes bad, and Michael Jr. sees Daddy in a violent sprawl, and then shit hits the fan from there.
Boy, howdy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got a great cast. I think it's got Daniel Craig before Daniel Craig was Daniel Craig.
Yeah.
It's got Jude Law, and I think one of his better performances that I've ever seen him in.
I think it's one of his best.
Yeah, Tom Hanks is superb as always.
Now, we might have a slight disagreement on that one.
Really? I like him a lot. I like him as a kind of an anti-hero as opposed to just a normal good guy.
No, I agree. I love the casting. Like, I think he's great in that kind of role because it's not very common. But what I thought is in his acting, it seemed like to me he was trying to act like his character was not so smart. I mean, not to say that he's dumb, just that he wasn't fully aware or had a full understanding of what was going on around him and the consequences that might happen. But I could see in his eyes that maybe it's just Tom Hanks himself. He just looks smart enough to know all that. So there was just this little slight, just a couple of scenes in particular where I felt like he was trying to act dumber than he actually is.
Hmm.
Do you mean that the character was trying to deceive people by acting dumber than he was?
I think his acting choice, I think he was trying to make Michael Sullivan not fully intelligent person.
I didn't get that at all.
It seemed like Michael Sullivan was not as smart as Tom Hanks, but because it's Tom Hanks, that didn't really ring true.
Oh, so you just expect him to be smarter because he's played by Tom Hanks.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because I know Tom Hanks is an intelligent man. So when I saw the character Michael Sullivan saying things or doing things that weren't as smart as they probably should be, it kind of had this slight little sliver of falsehood for me.
I think being a mob enforcer that shoots people should kind of give you the idea of what kind of a person that this guy is. And usually, I guess mob enforcers that aren't in jail or, you know, in prison or whatever, are probably pretty intelligent or, you know, law enforcement sucks. But,
yeah, but when it comes to, enforcement or kind of acting as like a bodyguard, I mean, they're there more for their brawn than their brains.
Exactly.
But I don't know, maybe it was just an issue with the script. Maybe it was just certain things he said came off as, you know, they should have been not as smart as Tom Hanks is actually projecting. But I don't know, I'm being really nitpicky. I mean, other than that.
Yeah, I can't remember any lines or anything that struck me as his character being less intelligent.
There's just a couple of spots where he seems surprised at a certain reaction of one of the other characters. And I'm like, come on, you got to be smarter than that. You ought to know this is how it goes. I mean, you've been around this mob world almost your entire life. Why are you surprised that these people are coming after you?
Well, why is he surprised that he's not allowed to go back after them?
Oh, yeah, like that. That kind of
thing. Yeah, I guess him kind of assuming that the mob boss of Chicago is going to be okay with it, you know. He can't worry about somebody else's territory and what happens on it.
Yeah, I'm being really nitpicky. Other than that, I think this is probably one of the – I mean, on a directorial stance, I think this is so flawlessly directed. This is just a breathtaking piece of cinema. I've actually seen it once before, but this is probably back in my late-night drinking days. So there was very little I remembered about this. So I was really stoked you picked it again to watch it because I've been wanting to see it again. And I'm just floored, totally floored by this movie. It is an amazing piece of work, and I love the themes of – I mean, it's kind of laid out in The Voice by the Son at the end about how a son's perspective of his dad is never whether or not he's a good or a bad man. It's almost always instinctively, my father is a good man, even when he's asked to do bad things, whereas the outside world might perceive him as, you know, this guy's a mobster. Of course he's a bad man.
Yeah, I liked that. I didn't like the voiceover at the beginning or the end, but I like that theme. I agree with you there.
Yeah, I'm usually not – usually a fan of voiceover, but I think here it was used so sparingly and just a bookend that I think it worked pretty well.
Yeah, I think it can do without it. Sometimes I feel like voiceovers are just a little bit too direct trying to tell us what they're trying to get across, you know, instead of us figuring it out for ourselves. But yeah. I didn't have too much of a problem with the voiceover because I think this movie is just too good to really care about something like that.
Yeah.
That's so good. And I think it's kind of funny. Sam Mendes is probably more famous for American Beauty. But looking back on that now, I don't think American Beauty really is handling the test of time as much. Like, I think Road to Perdition might end up being hailed as Mendes' masterpiece.
Is this that highly regarded?
American Beauty?
I didn't know that. I don't hear people even talk of it as often as it deserves to be talked about.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I used to think really highly of it, but I think back on it now, and I think I might have just been overly excited about it.
I mean, not to say that it's bad, I just don't think it's as timeless as Road to Perdition.
I really like seeing Paul Newman, although, I don't know, you didn't see him that often.
This was his last role, right?
Yeah, he wasn't in it for a whole long time.
This was his last role?
I think so.
This might have been his last movie.
I was not aware of that. Wow, that's cool.
We can find out. I don't think so.
His last feature film. Looks like everything else after that has been on TV or voice work or documentary.
Yep, you're right. Looks like it was his last full role as John Rooney, the mob boss.
That's cool. He did a good job. He did what was required, and I don't know, not a lot of heavy acting was required for the part, but it was cool to see him.
Well, not necessarily heavy acting, but I think he did a really excellent job of, especially in the scene where Stanley Tucci, who does he play? Like Capone, is it?
Sure.
He's the Chicago guy?
Yeah, it's when they're in Chicago then.
Yeah, he's the boss in Chicago, and I thought he was great. But when he's talking to Paul Newman about, you know, what would you do if Michael Sullivan was just a random dude, not someone you'd cared for? And you can see the grief on his face because he knows what he has to do, even though he's so conflicted about it. He knows that's just what you do in this world. You can't really consider a mo investment. So I thought that came across really well.
I thought a lot of his scenes are great. I thought when he was so frustrated with Connor, you know, after he had gone and murdered the wrong child, you know, the wife and the wrong son.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's, you know, beating him, but then he hugs him afterwards. I think that's a really powerful scene. Him being so disappointed,
yeah.
But it's his son that he can't really do anything about it.
That character was in a tough spot. I don't know. The movie's so much about sons and fathers and that dynamic, you know.
Definitely
like how much,
father-son.
Yeah, yeah. How much you love your father or how much you love your son, even if they mess up. Or even if you have to look at them in a less than perfect light, just the way... I don't know, the way that you deal with family relationships.
Oh, and I think this one particularly captured a look of a kind of a graphic novel pretty well, because I don't think it's very obvious like the other two might have been, but there are some specific scenes where it feels like it's ripped from the pages of like a noir comic book, like the scene where they stop at the diner for dinner. And the kid stays in the car because they pull up to that and there is nothing else in the background. It's just the diner and darkness behind it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then again,
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. And then again, with the scene where he takes his vengeance on the gang in that brilliant scene where the sound's out, there's only the score, no bullets. I thought that was just an incredibly beautiful scene. I mean, maybe it's because I watched it on Blu-ray, but I was just blown away by how gorgeous this brutal act of violence was.
No, it was perfect.
That was one of my favorite scenes also. I also liked a lot how they used the camera almost kind of as misdirection or in ways that the action that you're going to see will be surprising. I remember a couple times, you know, Tom Hanks would shoot someone and then the camera would quickly pan over to another person and then you don't see Tom Hanks shoot because he's out of frame by that point, but then you see that person get shot. And just things like that where the cinematography was creative and used in a way where you're constantly being surprised in the action scenes by things that are going on. Well, and it's really diverse because the scene we were just talking about, the end where he massacres like a whole lot of people right by the car, is completely different. Like slow motion, methodical, but both techniques are used well and beautiful.
So we haven't really talked at all about Jude Law's character, Harlan McGuire. He's sort of a contract killer that makes his living wage, his public wage, photographing dead bodies. Mm-hmm. But he's sort of a collector of these bodies he's killing, and he's photographing them. I think I don't know how to describe his character, how it makes me feel.
Terrified.
He's probably
terrified.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a creepy dude, and I'd say his character is probably the most in line with what you might expect from a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think the stylistic choices for his character, as well as, like, what kind of character he was, I don't know, would have necessarily made it into a movie that was just being made without a graphic novel as a source material.
I kind of wonder
you
what
might have similar character.
I kind of wonder what these dead photos would look like in the graphic novel.
Oh, good point, yeah. You should have to do that up.
Yeah, it'd just be real interesting to compare these, because graphic novels are sort of, you know, like the pre-storyboards of movies like this.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it'd be interesting to go through and see, like, oh, you know, this is a direct scene from this. It's part of the novels, you know, but I have a feeling I hope, at least, that a lot of his character is directly derived from the source material.
I think that Jude Law's character has to, because he seems so comic booky, even after he's shot Tom Hanks toward the end of the movie, and you look at him and you see his face that's been damaged from being shot earlier, and it's so scary. Like, that image of him, like, looking above his camera and that smile, that just screamed graphic novel for me. That was probably my favorite moment in the whole thing. Even though there are a lot of great moments, that one was just like, whoa, I don't like that. Like,
yeah.
Scary.
Yeah, I love the climax of this film. Tom Hanks' death scene, I think, is one of the best death scenes, one of the most convincing. Because there's always something about a death scene that rings a little false, because you know the actor's not really dying. But this one, I don't know, this one was really good. But when they come up to that house, because Jude Law's character had been gone since the last interaction, you know he's going to be waiting in that house. I mean, that just seems kind of obvious.
I was confused why Tom Hanks' character wasn't looking for him.
Yeah, I was anticipating, yeah.
I was anticipating it, and so I was like, something's going to happen. You know, we can't just forget about this character. You know, he's got to come back, and I'm just waiting for it to happen. And it happens exactly when it should.
I mean, if only for the reason that Michael Sullivan had to get his comeuppance. I mean, in cinema worlds, especially in noir, you don't ever get away with evil deeds. Something always comes back to get you.
Yeah, that actually was the first time. Well, actually, still, those are a couple things that maybe bother me a little bit about the movie, if anything does, is that, you know, Tom Sullivan's not looking for this guy. He knows where they're going. He knows that Jude Law, well, he should know that Jude Law is going to be there. He knew that earlier in the film.
What I was saying earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, when he gets shot, I was confused why he's standing in front of a window. I was confused. I guess the bullets are just going into him and stopping. I was expecting the window to break or something, because he's standing immediately in front of it.
I feel like I need to rewatch the scene, because I think maybe he thinks that Jude Law's character actually dies. I mean, it gets revealed to us shortly after that he's still alive.
Oh, maybe.
And so we're aware that he's still alive, but for all intents and purposes, Tom Hanks thinks he's dead, and he's no longer a worry. I'd have to rewatch it now and focus on that, but...
Yeah, it might be safe to assume that if he suspected him to not be dead, he probably would have finished him off.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very valid point.
But then again, like Isaac said, sometimes, you know, maybe he's just being dumber than what we would expect from Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's just so used to always having the upper hand that he's not really experienced with that kind of, you know, anticipation or expectation.
But he's so careful all the time, like the diner scene. And he's a good actor. He's always thinking about the possibilities. Before he even was certain that Jude Law was there to kill him, he was being careful and he was watching. He gets up and pretends to be more drunk than he is and stumbles to the bathroom and then disappears as fast
and
as he
all
can.
That. Yeah, all that was intuition on his part. So, yeah, I don't know.
Right, yeah.
I think it would make sense then that he probably assumed that he was dead at the hotel.
Yeah, he must have.
Oh, man. This is one creepy dude.
Yeah. I think it works so well because it's so against Jude Law's type. Like, he's normally the pretty boy in the movies, and he's just a gross, haggard-looking creeper.
Yeah, it's probably the best way to describe him.
Yeah. So of these three... I guess it's kind of hard to gauge which one was the best adaptation, but maybe which one was the best graphic novel-ish.
Hmm.
I think the most graphic novel screams V for Vendetta because it's over the top a little bit more than I think the other two are.
Yeah.
I would agree. I wouldn't call Ghost World, even though it's very, very much like, it looks exactly like its graphic novel. The graphic novel is such strange subject matter. The graphic novel to begin with is not very graphic novel-y. I think V for Vendetta is the most like looking at a comic strip or illustrations.
I also think thematically as well, that one's story and theme would probably be the one you'd most typically expect to find in a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm. But I love that father-son path, you know, consequences of violent actions, you know, story can be a graphic novel. I think it's great.
Yeah, yeah. But I was going to say, I think there are individual scenes in Road to Perdition that I think are more in tune with a graphic novel than with V for Vendetta. But there's only like two or three in Road to Perdition that I can think of that are above that. But it also, you have to know that it was a graphic novel first before you kind of can recognize those elements.
Yeah, you didn't know that Road to Perdition was a graphic novel until this.
Not until you
did I.
Yeah.
But of the three, that's the one I want to pick up the most.
Really?
I think so. If I was going to go pick one up to read, I think I'm more interested in that one than V. I mean, I'm interested in V, but I think it's because I could relate more to the father-son dynamic in Road to Perdition than I could with the revolution of V for Vendetta. I think it's a more personal and universal story in Road to Perdition.
I think I'd agree with Isaac. I want to read Road to Perdition, and I own Ghost World, and I've read V before, but watching that movie, I don't know. I want more of the story. I want to read it now. So,
to me, I definitely want to read Road to Perdition. But at the same time, I think the most that I'd probably associate with is going to be V for Vendetta because of the revolution and the struggle.
An episode?
I think so. That's going to be a long one.
Some movies merit a longer discussion.
Yeah, like these ones.
Yeah, you know what? Overall, I thought they were all good, so I'm not bummed about watching any of those movies.
Oh, agree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
To get involved in the discussion, you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/3filmegos, follow us on Twitter, @3filmegos, or email us at 3filmegos@gmail.com. You can also comment at 3filmegos.podomatic.com, where you can also donate and subscribe to the show. Music provided by 90s Television. You can hear more of their music on Facebook. On our next episode, Dreams. We've been the 3 Filmegos. Thanks for listening.